Joey Block. Well, it's been a busy week for the Trump transition team. A lot of big moves that they've been making, also followed with a lot of controversy. Let's review them here. So Trump filled many more key cabinet posts. Then one nominee dropped out, followed by the president-elect naming a new person to fill that role. And then on top of that, another pick is currently facing sexual assault allegations. A lot that's going on here. Let's go through this here. Trump has nominated former Florida Attorney General Pam Bondi to head the Justice Department after former Sunshine State Congressman Matt Gaetz withdrew from consideration. In a Truth Social post, Trump wrote, quote, "For too long, the partisan Department of Justice has been weaponized against me and other Republicans. Not anymore. Pam will refocus the DOJ to its intended purpose of fighting crime and making America safe again." Close quote. Bondi previously worked on a Trump commission focused on ending the opioid crisis and combating drug addiction. She also served on the defense team for Trump's first Senate impeachment trial and was part of his legal challenges in Pennsylvania over the 2020 election results. The announcement comes just hours after Matt Gaetz formally withdrew his nomination following allegations of sexual misconduct. In a post on X, Gaetz wrote, "While the momentum was strong, it is clear that my confirmation was unfairly becoming a distraction to the critical work of the Trump-Vance transition. There is no time to waste on needlessly protracted Washington scuffle. Thus, I'll be withdrawing my name from consideration to serve as Attorney General. Trump's DOJ must be in place and ready on day one." Trump responded to the withdrawal with a Truth Social post saying, quote, "I greatly appreciate the recent efforts of Matt Gaetz in seeking approval to be Attorney General. He was doing very well, but at the same time did not want to be a distraction for the administration, for which he has much respect for." Close quote. This comes after the House Ethics Committee failed to come to an agreement on whether they should release their report on the investigation into Gaetz's alleged sexual misconduct and illicit drug use. Gaetz has been accused of paying for underage girls to come across state lines and have sex with him. CNN is reporting a woman testified to the House Ethics Committee that there were two encounters in which she witnessed with Gaetz at a party in 2017 when she was a minor. The woman reportedly said the second encounter was a threesome. Now, it's important to note here, though, that the person she identified as participating in the act along with her and Gaetz has denied any such thing has happened. Now, when asked for comment on this specific story, Gaetz followed it up with this simple withdrawal. DOJ conducted its own investigation and decided not to charge him with anything. Gaetz has denied all of these allegations. So, a lot to unpack with this one because it's a complicated story, to say the least, and it has a lot of implications. First, with Pam Bondi, she is a Trump loyalist. She is very much Trump-esque. She's bombastic. She sticks with her guns. She is someone who stands for conservative principles and fights for conservative causes. And that is someone who very much is in the mold of what Trump would be looking for, but also is someone who would probably be a standard pick in a Republican administration. Obviously, she spearheaded efforts to fight the Affordable Care Act, which Democrats will probably use against her. but she's also someone who is a lot easier to get behind. And if you recall, this was a very quick turnaround from Gates announcing the "I'm out of here" to, "Oh boy, here's Pam," which leading people wonder what exactly was going on with this. Because if you look at the timeline closely, the Health Ethics Committee was basically on the verge of completing their investigation, releasing this report. And then Trump shocked Washington by nominating Gates as the top law enforcement officer of the land. So then he decides to resign immediately from Congress. And not only that, but also saying he wasn't going to take the oath of office for the next term of Congress, which he had just won and ran for re-election. So Gates is all out of Congress altogether. And it's typically the House Ethics Committee policy not to release reports or to continue investigations on former members. Basically, once they leave Congress, they put the sword down and like, oh, we're not going to do anything. But because of the unprecedented nature in which Gates was being nominated for and considered for a federal position within the government, a lot of members of the Senate really wanted to see this report and take these allegations very seriously. So it leads to questions. Was there a coordinated effort here to get Gates out of Congress? And you could argue whether it's gracefully or not, but essentially a saved man, meaning he didn't go out, quote unquote, in shame. He was leaving Congress for the specific purpose of getting a promotion, which never came to pass. Or did this just happen to all be coincidence? Was there purpose to this? And did Trump know deep down that Gates was not going to get confirmed, that this was just a get-out-of-jail-free card for him, but he was going to pick the real person all along? He was just waiting for the right moment. That's some questions we may never have the answer to. Although the reports are out there that Trump was really pushing for Gates. He was getting on the phones with the senators, really trying to push this through. And also, Vance was on the Hill with him earlier this week, trying to meet with senators and see what they could do there. And basically, they were trying to get him over the finish line of someone who could carry out the Trump agenda, but he was a controversial figure, especially given what happened with Kevin McCarthy. Because you recall, Gates wanted this House Ethics Committee investigation squashed a long time ago, but McCarthy was not willing to do it. But he still needed Gates' votes for stuff. So, you know, he'd give him a bone here and there, but that was enough for Gates. And ultimately, that led him, along with a number of other Republicans, to give McCarthy the axe by voting to vacate the chair. And that created the scuffle that we saw in Washington last fall, where Republicans had to pick a new speaker and all that, and the nine yards there, which led to Mike Johnson ultimately getting the job. So Gates is a disruptor, for sure. And these allegations, although obviously law enforcement chose not to formally charge him with anything, do bring doubts, because there are a lot of reports of Gates literally on the House floor showing his colleagues photos, sexually explicit photos of women that he had either had relations with or he was dating or maybe he found attractive. And it really grossed a lot of people out. And then also, of course, using the drug use and, you know, women accusing him of, you know, having all these drugs at all these parties and being under the influence while having sex with him. And also the underage part of the actually flying the girls over, you know, not necessarily trafficking themselves, but paying for them and getting on a plane and bringing them over from from Mexico or other South American countries is a very serious thing. That's what's out there. That's what people are accusing the now former congressman of. And he's always said it's just a witch hunt. There's nothing to see here. But as you've noticed, a lot of his Republican colleagues, particularly male colleagues, have pushed back against him and have really said they don't like him being in Congress. And it's almost as if this is all cooked up to get him out. Now, we don't know anything for a fact, but it's possible. Now, obviously, for the Republicans, a little bit of a reset. Now you got Pam Bondi in the scene. Now, what's she going to do? Well, you're going to want to stand by her. And the pick, obviously, a little obvious, too. You have to wonder whether the optics were the fact that Gates was accused of sexual misconduct and then Trump comes out with a woman pick. Was that in response to Gates, or was this essentially who he wanted to pick all along? But then Gates was going through this issue and he just said, you know what, I'll just play this game for a while and see what happens. And her being a woman definitely sets the tone there of, obviously, you're not going to be asked those same questions. There are questions she's going to be asked about cases she prosecuted while she was working for the state of Florida in the capacity as the Sunshine State's Attorney General. She's going to be asked about that, as well as her interactions with Trump. There's obviously some questions there about how she handled certain cases in regards to Trump. We will be seeing how she responds to that, especially in a confirmation hearing. Obviously an experienced person. So for her, she's going to want to stick with that and talk about things as someone who's done it before and to not maybe tout all the partisan talking points that she has in the past, especially when it comes to the 2020 election stuff, because, you know, Democratic lawmakers are going to want to ask her about that. Now, if you're a Democratic lawmaker, you're going to want to obviously bring up Gates. It's a whole Florida thing. But you can't paint her with Gates' allegations because it's all separate stuff. She wasn't involved with it at all. So you can't necessarily use the same line of attacks. But if you're the Democrats, you're going to want to poke holes in this, talk about the Affordable Care Act, talk about her past with LGBTQ rights, talk about her relationship with Trump, the 2020 election, that kind of stuff, maybe some conflict of interest stuff. That's what you're going to want to pick at if you're going to pick at this nominee. Now, there are other Trump nominees out there who are far more controversial, who Democrats may want to go after the low-hanging fruit rather than mess with Pam Bondi. And that it could be more, it could be a slightly more uneventful hearing. Is it going to be like a Marco Rubio near rubber stamp? Probably not. Or a Doug Burgum type of thing? Doubt it. There's going to be some hard questions asked. But it certainly is not going to be what would have been the very contentious Matt Gaetz confirmation hearing, where a lot of questions would have been spiraling about his, we'll say, after work activities. And maybe during work activities, based on what you hear going on the House floor. So it's going to be a different type of hearing for sure. And the Republicans are going to want to make it clear that she is a law enforcement officer who's going to bring the DOJ back to the status of independence. Because that's something we saw with Merrick Garland, right? He was appointed, supposed to be an independent guy, and we want independence. We don't want a guy who's going to influence the Justice Department. And that is what Republicans have claimed has been going on since Garland has been in office. So Bondi's going to want to put that perception up that, whoa, we're not doing that here. I'm not influenced by Trump. I'm not influenced by Democrats or Biden or any of that stuff. I'm just here to look at the law and see where the facts go. For Bondi, if she wants to get to the finish line, she's going to have to do that. And the Republicans are going to have to do that too in the messaging. If they want to get her over the finish line. Now, J.D. Vance was on Capitol Hill trying to get Gates over the finish line. But then he also, that wasn't the only nominee he was torn around the Capitol. He also was escorting former Fox News host Pete Hegseth around. Hegseth is Trump's defense secretary nominee. He's coming under fire for alleged sexual assault. And that's according to a police report that has now come to light. It was just released this week to the public. According to this report, a woman told police Hegseth took her phone and blocked her from leaving his hotel room before the sexual assault took place in 2017. The incident allegedly took place after a Republicans' women convention in California. Again, all the way back to 2017 here. Police documents say the woman, identified only as Jane Doe, didn't remember a lot of what happened and the encounter that took place. Doe did say she believes some sort of drug may have been slipped into her drink. The report says it all started when the woman confronted Hegseth for what she said was his treatment of women. She said he didn't really do a good job at that. From there, she went to the bar at the hotel with a group of female friends where Hegseth was present. Now, she says she didn't drink a lot there other than a small amount of champagne. The report then goes on to say that surveillance footage shows the woman, Hegseth, and an unknown female walking into the hotel lobby towards the bar around midnight. Then the woman and Hegseth are reportedly seen locking arms around 1 a.m., so just an hour later. Now from there, she says things get a little fuzzy. She says that, you know, she found herself in this hotel room, an unknown room, where Hegseth asked her who she was texting and snatched the phone right out of her hands when he blocked the exit to the room. So trapped her in there, essentially. The woman then claimed that his dog tags were hanging all over her and that she was bare-chested entire. And from there, he got on top of her and performed a sexual act. Hegseth told police that it was consensual and made sure she was okay with everything going on. He claims sex was not part of the plan for the night, but he did find it odd she sat there in the room and didn't leave. Hegseth told police they both several times throughout said, "We shouldn't do this," before then continuing mutually to embrace one another. And of course, the woman in her account said that there was a lot of no, no, no going on, just to keep it all in perspective here. Now, he has not been charged for this encounter at all. When asked about this during the week on the Hill, Hegseth said, quote, "As far as the media is concerned, I'll keep this very simple. The matter was fully investigated, and I was cleared. And that's where I'm going to leave it." Close quote. The allegations emerge when Hegseth confirmed that he paid an undisclosed amount of money as part of a settlement with his accuser. So with this story, there are more complexities than with the Gates one. Because the Gates one, yes, there was no charging, but there was all of these transfers that the ethics committee supposedly had of Venmo, and that they had all the documentation that could back this up. While here, they did a lot of interviews. They did some interviews with people who worked at the hotel, the woman's husband, Hegseth, the woman. They They talk to people who are at the bar at night. So they have a complete picture here. And it's murky because these things are very careful. You have to very carefully talk about these because you don't ever want to assume, unless you have the hard evidence, either side of the story. You want to obviously honor it and believe them, but you don't want to disparage them unless you have the overwhelming evidence for either end. And that's what we have here, is there could be some murkiness in this. Now, you have the woman's account, where obviously if you heard that, just by itself, you're like, oh my God, this is insane. But then you have Hegseth, who almost makes it sound like, well, this woman really wanted some action here, and I'm tried to make sure everything was okay. I said we shouldn't do it, but it seemed like she wanted to do it anyways. So you have these two different interpretations of what's going on. Now, where the truth is, that may lie somewhere in the middle. Now, of course, the police report is saying that they were locked in arms around 1 a.m. So there clearly was an embrace there. Doesn't say what she, if it was, you know, something she was uncomfortable with or not. But usually when you lock arms, there is something consensual. But again, doesn't know. Remember, Pete Hegseth in 2017, he may have not been as big as he is now, but you know, a big star, you might feel obligated to do that. So you have to keep that in mind too. There is coercion that could possibly have happened too, where you consent to the action, but it's more under pressure that if you don't, then something different may occur. You might not get what you want, whether you're afraid they're going to reject you in life, whether you're going to miss out on opportunity, whether something will be, you'll be deprived of something. This is the kind of stuff that could go through someone's mind to where it's, yes, on paper it's consensual. Yes, you're saying it. You might not be happy about it, but, you know, this is something that you did consent to, even though you really didn't want it. It could be that red line, too. So you have to play all sides of the fence with that. Now, then you have to bring into the factor, there was a payment. Why was there a payment? Well, Hegseth says, and his attorneys say, it's largely because of the Me Too movement in the times, and they just wanted to get rid of this thing. Now, it could be because Hegseth was married at the time, and I believe he actually had another affair going on. So he didn't, you know, with his career, he probably didn't want, you know, working at a conservative news network where he's supposed to be all religious and godly and all that, want this getting out, and, you know, said, all right, we'll just pay her off and be done with this. And maybe it wasn't. But it could also be alluding to there was something more to this, and he just paid her off to get rid of this and be on his way. So complicated, right? It could go either way, depending on how you look at this story. But, and again, we're not assuming here anybody is guilty or not guilty. We're just reporting what's here. That's what we're trying to do here. We're not trying to draw any massive conclusions other than get you to think about it and how it affects this nomination. Now, getting to the more political aspect of it, this is not great stuff to be having when you're obviously trying to go up for a government job, especially when there's already questions lingering around whether Hegseth is truly up for it, given the fact that he does not have the experience that most people have going to this job. I mean, Lloyd Austin, for example, you know, was a general. Then also James Mattis, when he got into the job, he was a general at some point. And then you had Mark Esper. He had a lot of experience too. So these guys were far more prepared than Hegseth maybe. That's the argument that's out there. So you have that. And he says he's a veteran guy and he was a major, and that he, that type of experience, real world experience in the military, is what's going to help him in this job. So you have all that surrounding too, Hegseth. And you had Vance, you know, going around trying to get him to, you know, get some support among senators. And there are senators who are coming to his side. So Hegseth, unlike Gates, is getting some support coming in. But can he get the backing of the key people? The Lisa Murkowskis, the Susan Collins, the Bill Cassidys, the Mitch McConnells of the world. Those are the people you're going to need. Because based on the way the Senate's right now, if you lose 4 votes, you're done. 3, you can get on a tiebreaker as long as that Vance seat is filled in a timely fashion and they still have Marco Rubio in the position. Because, again, the way it looks like they're going to do this is that no one's going to resign until the appointments that they're going up for and the nominations, they actually start going through the process and getting confirmed. So if that's the case, then Rubio may, in theory, be able to vote on this and get this over the finish line. But again, there's still a lot of work to be doing. And for Hegseth, you have to paint it as, well, you know, they cleared me. I know this doesn't look great. You know, maybe you don't necessarily like the way I live my life and the choices I've made in my love life. But hey, listen, this isn't going to affect the job I'm doing. That is what you're kind of hearing from him, right? And for Republicans, they're probably going to want to focus on the veteran thing and, you know, the support of Trump thing. And that, you know, he's a regular guy just trying to make change in his department. It's a civilian-run department. That's what people like to call it. So if you're the Republicans, you're going to try and make that argument. Now, if you're the Democrats, they're going to poke holes in this like crazy. You're going to talk about these allegations. You're going to talk about him and his stance on women in combat. You're going to talk about conservative stances he's taken. And you're going to talk about the lack of experience. This is stuff that's going to come up. And Hegseth is going to have to be ready for these questions if he is going to get through the nomination. Because as you know, this is not going to be an easy walk in the park confirmation hearing for Hegseth. For Marco Rubio, it might be a little different story. Sean Patrick Duffy, which, you know, I wanted to talk about this week, but we're not going to have time to really dive into that one. But I do have a good story I'm going to have to say at one point. Well, not much of a story, more of a comment. But anyways, those are people you're probably not going to really see much excitement at these confirmation hearings. It's probably going to be a lot of rubber stamping. These guys, like Hegseth, Gates would have been, RFK Jr., Tulsi Gabbard, all these people, they're going to have a tougher ride. So Hegseth has to be ready to defend himself in that regard and have answers for this and self-reflection and innocence. Because if he can't convince these senators that he is, then it's a problem. Because chances are he's not getting the John Fettermans of the world. He's not getting that moderate Democratic vote like Marco Rubio is going to get. And maybe even Dr. Oz, crazy as it seems, because Fetterman, who ran against Oz, said he would actually vote for him in that position if he promises to keep Medicare and Medicaid in place. So, you know, there are people who are going to get bipartisan support in this cabinet. But Pete Hegseth may not, and there's a good chance he's not, but we'll have to see. Maybe he'll convince people, he'll bring people into the fold. And also, there are reports, and we don't have 100% verification, that the Trump team is looking at alternatives to Pete Hegseth. And that was really before the Gates news came down, that we were starting to see these reports come through. And we did not know at the time that Pam Bondi was basically in the back pocket of Trump ready to go. So if he had her ready, does he have someone ready for Hegseth? That's some questions that we may know the answer to. We may not. Maybe someone on the transition team will give us a little 411 on that. Point being is, these allegations are serious, whether they are true or not, and there are going to be senators who are going to take this very seriously, and he's going to be asked some hard questions. He says he's innocent. We'll see. Is he going to go into detail about them? Is he going to be comfortable with it? It's a lot of prep. But he's an Ivy League guy, so as the Republicans will say, they'll use that as a plus. Well, Democrats are probably going to call foul on it, saying, well, you know, you guys talk about how much you hate Ivy League people, but yet you're defending the guy saying he's an Ivy League guy. That's the world we live in politics these days. But we'll see what happens with Hegseth's confirmation. Does he get to live another week? That is the question, because, you know, this time last week we were just talking about the Gates thing, and now Gates is no more, at least in Congress and in the Trump cabinet. We'll see what happens to Gates, and we'll see what happens with Hegseth going forward. Here's what we're getting in the middle of this week. When you're in need of a drink, you may go to a local bar or go to the liquor store to pick up a pack of beer if you're buying alcohol for the big game. But that's not the case for all towns in New Jersey. In addition to voting for president, Senate, Congress, and the like, one town decided to allow liquor sales within its borders. After 120 years of this town going completely dry and not really allowing liquor licenses to be had in the town, being a dry town, residents of a South Jersey borough, which is Haddon Heights, said enough is enough. The residents there voted in favor of a referendum permitting alcohol sales to take place in the town. So this is new. This is brand new here. It was part of a non-binding resolution, you know, proposed by government officials to kind of get a gauge for where the community is at on this issue. Supporters of the ballot initiative say that it's going to bring more business into the community and allow the town's restaurant industry to thrive. Joining me now is the Democratic mayor of Haddon Heights, Zachary Houck. Mayor Houck, thanks for coming on.
Thanks, Joey. It's an honor to be here.
Haddon Heights residents recently voted to allow alcohol to be sold in town. What's your reaction?
Yeah, so obviously I was for this ordinance introduction, and we brought it to mayor and council, and they agreed that they believe the town would benefit from introducing a liquor ordinance in the community. But just due to the nature of the historic community, we wanted to offer the opportunity for the public to voice their opinion. And 3-2 margin, you know, on a yes for introducing liquor ordinance in town was huge. And I'm glad that the public voted in favor of it. I'm excited for, you know, the opportunities that are going to come along with us introducing this referendum.
Your municipality has been considered a dry town for 120 years. You talked about how this referendum was brought to the mayor and the council. What prompted this referendum to be put on the ballot? Was there just like a catalyst of like, okay, because this happened, now we really got to consider this?
Yeah, so obviously back in 21, there's a little bit of a backstory here. So Heights kind of explored the idea of, and they did an informal survey, not a referendum, I want to say about a decade ago. And it was kind of pushed by a couple of restaurants in town. And at the time, the community then was in favor of it. But I've never seen those survey results. But now, flash forward to today, we started down a path of redevelopment and rehabilitation in our community for our business district, our main street. And we just felt it appropriate that this was a great time and an opportunity for us to enhance the redevelopment push through introducing liquor licenses. And so myself and Councilwoman Phillips we started talking about the idea within our small working group for redevelopment. We pitched it to mayor, to the rest of council, and generally everybody was in favor of it, but there was that question. It's 120 years. The community has been a dry town, not by the way it was formed. There was no ordinance, or it wasn't written into our charter that said you couldn't have liquor licenses. But there was no ordinance permitting liquor licenses in town. And so traditionally we've just been a dry community. But for those that aren't familiar with South Jersey, we are what you would call like a pike town. So we're like 1.5 square miles. And it is at one time 100 years ago, there was farms in between our towns and between our downtowns and our main streets. Today, you cannot distinguish one town from the next if you're not from the area. And so our neighboring communities of Barrington and Audubon and Mount Ephraim all have liquor licenses and ordinances on the book. So again, we thought this would be an opportunity, but because of the historic nature of it, 120 years, we wanted to give the opportunity for the public to vote. So what better year to ask them for their opinion? And it was like a non-binding referendum. So just, again, it was kind of like a formal survey of opinions. And we felt the best year to introduce this would be a presidential year because you get the biggest voter turnout. And that's what we did. And we had just shy of 3,600 people participate in this referendum question. Unfortunately, about 800 people missed the referendum question. And that's just kind of like the nuances of the ballot system right now.
You say that it's non-binding. So in theory, if for some strange reason the council wanted to go a different way, they would technically be allowed. It's not like a legal set in stone kind of thing.
Correct. Yeah. So it was a non-binding referendum, allows us to really just like test the waters and survey the community for their opinion and give us a little bit of a feedback. The community is changing over. I think it's definitely becoming younger, and you're seeing that on every street and block in the town where you have young families moving to town. I think COVID drove a little bit of this. Yeah, a lot of people that I meet today on the street, they moved from South Philly. They moved, came over the river, moved to our small community because they wanted to escape like the density of the city. And so ultimately the town is kind of a little bit younger. Generally the vibe, we're not technically a dry town as you would think, like an Ocean City. We do have a small craft brewery in town. We had two at one time. We still have one, Tanner Brewing. Plus a lot of our restaurants sell New Jersey wine. And again, that's all tied to like the nuances of New Jersey liquor laws.
You bring up the fact that even though Haddon Heights is considered a dry town, there actually are some alcohol sales that have been happening in it, whether it is the brew, whether it is these restaurants serving local wine. Just for people who may be, not as up on the little nitty details of this, what is the difference between what this referendum does and what would happen if this referendum didn't pass? So is there something that now your town is going to be able to do that it couldn't do before, given that the way the laws are written and the ordinance are?
Yeah, so this has come up a lot. I'm sure it's talked at the state level quite extensively. New Jersey liquor laws are it's a strange batch of laws. So you're permitted to have, we have craft brewery license, right? So in our town, even though we're a dry town, we had Lunacy Brewing before. They closed 2 years ago. We have Tanner Brewing now. So they're permitted again. They're small craft brewing. That's permitted in town. And pretty much the state regulates who those licenses and the way they're distributed. When it comes to the referendum question, the question was specifically, will we allow, I believe it's plenary retail consumption licenses, which is traditionally your restaurant bars. So like a nice restaurant where it has a bar inside where you can get a cocktail or a beer or a glass of wine. And it also would include your like corner bar, right? So that would be, there are your two types of establishments governed by that law. Within the New Jersey liquor laws, there's also, I'll probably say this slightly wrong, but it's, there'd be like retail packaged goods, which would be like your corner liquor store. as well as you can get into the nuances of like club licenses, which are like your VFWs, your American Legions, or your concessionaire's license, which that's where you get really creative. If you're a small town, if it's a government-owned piece of land, you could utilize a concessionaire's license on that site, which again would be kind of just like a restaurant or a bar, except the land is owned by the government. So, and then, and like I said, then there's winery, there's New Jersey, there's laws that govern New Jersey wineries, craft brewers, and distilleries. So, I mean, again, and all of them play kind of by a different set of rules, which makes things complicated in the state of New Jersey. And sometimes it feels maybe a little bit antiquated, especially when you look at like the challenges that are, that come with the plenary retail consumption licenses. So we're only permitted in Hatton Heights right now, due to our population of 7,400 and change, two of those licenses.
You mentioned that this liquor system is antiquated in regards to specifically to the state law. That is a word that Governor Murphy used to describe the system back when he was implementing liquor license reform. He signed a law at the beginning of the year that expanded the amount of liquor licenses out there. Obviously, in your situation, there still are, you know, some could argue more to go. Given the amount of licenses you have access to, or I should say would and will have access to, would you like to see these reforms expanded even more? Because if you go across the river from you in Pennsylvania, they have all these beer and wine stores, which expand the access. Maybe they don't have the hard liquor, but it does provide more access for more stores to be able to profit off of selling basic alcohol. Would you like to see something like that?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I'm a small town and I have several already established restaurants who will be actively competing for these licenses. But on top of that, like I said, I introduced redevelopment just after my first year in office in 21. And, you know, I've got a vacant bank, a very old, like 100-year-old bank building. It sits on the corner, would probably make for a beautiful restaurant. I've got a couple other areas in town that are zoned for redevelopment that I would love to kind of build out as like a city, like a town square, and really like just reimagine and revive certain areas of the town and expand our little footprint to make for a vibrant community. And it's very tough to say that liquor licenses on their own are going to do that for our community, because again, there's only two of them available. So that just becomes a challenge. And I, you know, you look at some of the communities around me, and I think that's why some of them have foregone even introducing an ordinance for themselves, because based on their population, they just wouldn't, you know, they wouldn't be able to offer enough licenses for all the restaurants in their town. So it becomes, you know, what's fair and what isn't. And, you know, you think about it, we're small towns and we want to promote small business, and we want to promote, I have a lot of resident run businesses here in our community. And, you know, the liquor license laws, when they were introduced in the state, they were tied to population. And when people traveled less between these communities, you know, 90 years ago, 80 years ago, you know, post prohibition, that maybe made sense. But today, when it's not uncommon that, you know, that people travel up and down the state. I can just as easily, in a few minutes, travel through 3, 4, 5 towns, up and down the pike. What's to say that the population of my town, or the population that would utilize the restaurants here in Haddon Heights, would just be from Haddon Heights and these neighboring towns? I'm sure if redevelopment continues in the direction that I want it to, Haddon Heights will become an awesome little destination for most of Camden County and the surrounding municipalities. And so, again, I think the liquor license laws are a little bit antiquated. The governor had high hopes, and as well as I. I think when the law he signed wasn't exactly how he wanted it to go. He was hoping for a sunset of the population clause by the year, I think, 2029. But there's challenges. I mean, it's government, and you know, you have to look at all the businesses that have spent a lot of money to acquire these licenses over the years. How do you make them whole? And so I'm sure there's just a little bit more work that needs to happen up in Trenton. to get it done. But I'm hopeful that the members of the Assembly and the Senate will work with the governor to get it done. And it'll be good for small business. It'll be good for small communities like Haddon Heights.
You brought up the surrounding communities and how they are affected, where towns that are neighboring you that don't have liquor licenses, you know, struggle to figure out how to get this off the ground because, you know, like the problem you mentioned, the lack of liquor licenses given the population. But then you have other towns on the other side of the equation where they actually are able to generate revenue based on having those liquor licenses. Would you say that your town is losing business to those towns that do have the liquor licenses, and that for residents who did vote for this, that was a driving factor in their vote, was to bring business back into your town as opposed to people leaving town to go to another bar?
Yeah, I mean, I'm known in town as a mayor who, if you write me an email or you send me a message on social media and I happen to know you happen to leave me your address or your phone number, I'm going to show up on your doorstep or I'm going to call you. And when I'm at the corner store in town, at the deli counter or something, and I start talking to our residents, everyone overwhelmingly supports the redevelopment push that we've been making for these last couple of years. And they're excited about a couple of projects that are coming. But again, it's like, you know, we have to be competitive. As a small town in a very dense county in South Jersey, we have to be competitive to attract new businesses, and not just the same old, you know, businesses, right? Something unique, something that's going to not only benefit the community from a tax and rateable base, but also from something that's going to attract more people to the downtown, right? So if I have 10 salons on my 2.5 blocks of Station Ave, that doesn't do me any good. But if I have a corner ice cream parlor, a deli, a small restaurant, a quick eats, a unique boutique clothing store, all right, now we're talking about something. There's a reason for me to go up to the downtown. And Haddon Heights is what we have, some beautiful parks, and there's a lot of pedestrian and foot traffic that goes through our community right now from both the adjacent communities and within Haddon Heights. And we can capitalize that on that even more, I think. But it's for Heights to be competitive. We have, you know, I champion redevelopment, and we're business friendly right now. And we have some areas that we're hoping we will attract developers to come in and reimagine some of these little corridors to create like a network of not just one downtown Main Street of two blocks, but a downtown Main Street of two blocks with a little suburban square three blocks away that you can bike to or walk to. And then two more blocks, you're on Barrington's downtown. And if you go, you know, a half mile in the other direction, you're on Audubon's downtown. And we can interconnect all these little downtowns to make it benefit not only Haddon Heights, but the entire kind of region. But again, to be competitive, you know, Haddon Heights' tools are going to be redevelopment. And these liquor licenses, I think, coupled with redevelopment, will really start to transform the community. But, you know, again, if the law would allow for us to have a few more, that would always be beneficial. But that's, again, that's where we have to get creative. And I mentioned earlier, like the concessionaire's license, the neighboring community of Pittman, just south of us, very similar to Heights in size, used concessionaire's licenses to rehab an old bank in town, issue an additional license, and bring a really cool restaurant to the downtown. So I think, again, we can get creative here. We have a couple lots of government-owned land that we could get creative on and hopefully attract the right developer to be partners with.
Now that residents have signed off on alcohol sales, what's next for this initiative?
So the next step would be we'll work with our professionals, a wise man on the ground listens to other wise people, and we do that here. You know, we talked with our professional and the cool thing about Haddon Heights is we've got a lot of talent that lives right here in our community. So I will probably host a special like forum meeting to welcome input from the community on how we craft that ordinance and the bid process going forward. But we'll work with our professionals. We'll craft an ordinance that'll probably be introduced after the first of the year. And then from there, we have to define the bid process to put the licenses out for bid in the community.
You say that the crafting of the ordinance would probably be after the first of the year. When would we actually see this be implemented to where businesses can get up and running, or at the very least start planning a process of building something where they can be up and running in only a matter of time?
I would venture to guess by spring we would have, we would introduce the first license up for bid. And really, New Jersey does give a lot of the control and the power specifically to the way the ordinance and the bids are crafted to the individual municipalities. But not knowing and not being familiar with the process, this is our first go around. And knowing how government sometimes works and having to work with the state, I would venture to guess, you know, late spring, hopefully by then, one restaurant at least has their hands on one of these licenses and they're beginning to put the ball in motion for their restaurant.
I know you already have some potential buyers in the mix. The reality is you only have two of these licenses to go around. How would you plan on determining who gets them? I know you're seeking input from the community, but just thinking off the top of your head here, would you like to see one be a liquor store and another be a bar and restaurant, or is that not really matter? Is there other factors at play?
Right. So actually, so we, for the packaged good, which would be like a liquor store, that license I think requires 7,500 residents. We're like on the bubble there. We'd have to go for some interpretation on that. But so the two licenses would be specifically like bar or restaurant. Like, so I think, you know, there's definitely, there's a desire, and I've heard this from several community members that were in favor of this, that we do thank the loyalty of so many, of two of our restaurants or three or four that have been here in the community for quite some time. And so I would work with our professionals to see if there's, you know, if there's an opportunity to allow for them to compete, you know, and put a requirement in there that you have pre-existing within the community already with an establishment. But ultimately, at least one of these licenses would, you know, to, again, couple it with redevelopment. It's beneficial for the community to really open it up to anybody that's looking to come in. And again, with that redevelopment that we introduced a couple of years ago, along with our existing zoning, the nice thing is that it gives us a lot of opportunity to kind of control where those licenses go in so that they benefit the community and in the process.
Last thing before we go, you're serving as a Democrat in a deep blue county that largely was unaffected by the national trend that took shape in the rest of the state this past election. Your party underperformed across the country, whether it was in races they lost or contests Democrats won by a much narrower margin than usual. Why do you think this happened?
Well, I mean, the first challenge is, you know, the presidential candidate Harris, you know, she, Vice President Harris, she got into the race late, you know, and that in itself, it's an uphill battle. The party did their best. You know, they had two options. There was rally behind her or try to find somebody else. And you're at a loss either way. Right. So, you're either going to start later than you already the late start you've started. And there's the potential for infighting, which could be disastrous for the party. So either way, you know, they rallied behind Vice President Harris, and unfortunately she had a late start. With that said, you look at the way the public voted. And I think at the end of the day, the campaign should have really been focused on the economy. And, you know, I hear that locally here. And it boils down to simple things, right? Like people, as much as they may care about some of the social issues, that's not what's driving them right now, right? It's like, it's as simple as Maslow's hierarchy of needs, right? Like you start at physiological needs and then safety and security, you know, like solid employment, being able to afford a house, you know, being able to afford groceceries. And that's what's driving, that was what was driving the public. And that was really what their concern is. And I think, being an incumbent as well, post-COVID, post-inflation, just poses a ton of challenges. And so, you know, hopefully the Democrat Party takes this lesson to heart and they reflect on it going into the midterms, you know, in 2 years, and they focus hard on what the public is really concerned with, and that's the economy. And so, you know, like locally here, you're right, like this is a deep blue county. We fared pretty well, but I still think we can't ignore it, right? Like that we'd be fools to stick our head in the sand. And so that's where, like, in a town like Haddon Heights, like I manage what I can manage, I control what I can control, and that's, here in Haddon Heights. Like, we're doing things like regionalization with like shared services with our neighboring communities, like DPW, fire, and EMS. And some of those that could be taboo to say in this state, you know, of hometown rule, but I think that's smart government. And fiscally smart government is good government. And that's what we have to do a better job of doing, especially here in New Jersey. Again, I heard a resident who was super supportive of everything I've been doing. And they admitted they were a Republican. But at the same time, they said, if you could do one thing, it would be lower my taxes. And I said, we'll work on it, you know. And again, and we really can only do that by being smart and working with our neighboring communities to look at like opportunities like regionalization. And yeah, I think that's the future of the party. We really have to reevaluate ourselves and focus on what the public is really concerned about right now. And that's how the economy is affecting their wallet.
You brought up earlier that Harris was kind of thrown into this thing at the third or fourth quarter of the game here. If your party stuck with Biden, do you think Democrats would have fared better, or do you think it would have been the same result?
That's a tough question, and I can't say I'm an expert on national politics to that level. I do think, you know, as I said earlier, being an incumbent post-COVID, post, you know, the inflation and the supply issue, chain issues, and all of these challenges, the war in the Middle East, you know, you have an uphill battle in general. So he would have had that same uphill battle. And yeah, I think that was a challenge. But after the first debate, I think the concerns really were, it was quite obvious that the public would have had confidence in President Biden defeating now President-elect Trump. And again, and that was really because they're looking for somebody to help with the economy. And at the end of the day, I wish the president-elect luck, and I you know, wish the best for him, in the sense of hopefully he listens to the people and he fixes the economy and he works to curb inflation. And you know, at the end of the day, that comes down to, well, everybody, not just the president. I mean, he's just one person. It comes to senators and congressmen reaching across the aisle and getting work done and cutting through the nonsense of the bureaucracy, getting work done. And I'll say, like, that's one thing here. Again, going locally, I am thrilled with, I had a meeting the other day with my partners at the county, and they do a lot of great work here in Haddon Heights, and they work with me to bring the county tax dollars back to the residents here in Haddon Heights. And that's what you need, regardless of whether it's your red town, a blue town, a red county, a red state, a blue state. It's, you know, we got to do a better job of working together to get stuff done.
We'll definitely see where things go over the next 4 years, both for your party as well as the country as a whole. We'll be watching for sure. Haddon Heights Democratic Mayor Zachary Houck, thank you so much for joining me. Really appreciate it.
Joey, thank you for the opportunity. This was I really enjoyed it, and I look forward to listening to this and some of the other shows coming up.
Now, before we go, I want to extend a very happy Thanksgiving, an early Thanksgiving, to all of you and to your friends and your families. It's definitely a fun time year, and hopefully the politics don't get too in the way. Since I know a lot of families are kind of divided, and, you know, with politics, you know, talk about it if it's comfortable. If it's not, don't talk about it. Just enjoy the time with the friends and the family, and really just enjoy the great food. And, you know, talk about what you do have in common, because that's what we really need right now. We had an election. The choice has been made. Whether you like it or not, take it for what it is and move on from it in a good sense. You know, obviously stay engaged, but don't cast off family members and friends just because they don't agree with you. The point being is, enjoy your Thanksgiving and rest up, as political season's not done yet. We still got one whole month to go and a lot of cabinet picks to talk about. Thank you so much for listening. It has been a pleasure. We'll be back here with more In the Middle next week, right here on Fox Sports, New Jersey.